What the hell is going on right now? And why is it happening like this? At Wired, we're obsessed with getting to the bottom of those questions, and maybe you are too. I'm Katie Drummond, the Global Editorial Director of Wired, and I'm hosting our new podcast series, The Big Interview. Each week, I'll sit down with some of the most interesting, provocative, and influential people who are shaping our right now. Listen to The Big Interview right now in the same place you find Wired's Uncanny Valley podcast.
Negotiators in the Middle East say they're getting closer to reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. A Palestinian father there tells us that after 2 years of war, death, and displacement, enough is enough.
This experience left deep scars on my heart.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. At The Hague, the International Criminal Court has convicted a Sudanese militia leader for war crimes committed 20 years ago.
He was credited with some of the planning around the genocidal attacks on the non-Arab populations in Darfur at the time.
Also today, memories of teenage drama with mom.
I wanted her to forbid me to go so I wouldn't have to. And I could tell her she'd ruined my life.
It actually turned into a great road trip. That's all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thanks for joining us today. A militia leader from Sudan has been found guilty of atrocities committed 20 years ago in the Sudanese region of Darfur. Ali Hosheib was convicted at the International Criminal Court on Monday on charges of mass murder and sexual violence going back to 2003. He claims it's a case of mistaken identity.
Hosheib is the first person to be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity committed in Darfur. Echoes of that conflict persist today in the brutal civil war that has engulfed all of Sudan. In a few minutes, we're going to hear a firsthand account of what's happening there. First, we turn to Khulod Kheir to understand the significance of this ruling at the ICC. She's the head of a think tank founded in Sudan, Confluence Advisory.
He's been found guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity for the Darfur genocide of 20 years ago. Now, he's one of five different people under ICC indictment, including the former president, Omar al-Bashir. He specifically, Ali Khosheib specifically, was known as the colonel of colonels, i.e. one of the main people on the ground that acted as a conduit between the military government in Khartoum and the Janjaweed forces and the popular defense forces that really led the genocide on the ground in Darfur. And as such, he was credited with some of the planning around the genocidal attacks on the non-Arab populations in Darfur at the time.
His charges go back to 2003. Why did it take so long to get a conviction?
It's taken a long time because, for one thing, it's been very difficult to get evidence out of Sudan. Under the Bashir regime, which lasted until 2019, there was almost no collaboration with the ICC. And in fact, there was a very hostile engagement by the government in Khartoum against the ICC and its successive prosecutors. Now, during the transitional period from 2019 to 2021, there was greater collaboration, but even then, the military government at the time stopped the prosecutors and the investigation teams from the ICC from going to Darfur to collect evidence as well as to collect victim testimonies. Mm. And since the coup of 2021, that has been almost impossible as well.
At the time, 20 years ago, the U.S. government determined that genocide was taking place in Darfur. Can you remind us what happened?
There were many people in Darfur at the time, particularly from non-Arab groups, that felt that the government in Khartoum was marginalizing them and stopping them effectively from engaging in opportunities that would better their lives, that put forward legal arrangements that made it difficult for them to live their lives how they wanted, etc. And as a result, rebellions grew in different parts of Darfur. Specifically, two main rebel movements came out of those conditions. And in order to quell those rebellions, the government in Khartoum, the military government in Khartoum, cultivated these Arab nomadic groups that became known as the Janjaweed to put down very violently this rebellion. And because of that, ethnic cleavages between those who were being attacked by the government and those who were putting up a rebellion against the government, what you had was effectively what looked like an ethnically driven conflict.
So more than 20 years later, one of the people responsible for this has been held to account. What does that guilty verdict mean for people in Sudan today?
Well, we've seen many from Darfur, particularly human rights groups from Darfur, as well as victims groups also from Darfur, come out very strongly to say, yes, it's taken a long time. Justice delayed is often justice denied. But it still matters to us that someone from the leadership of the campaign to annihilate our people has been found guilty. The ICC is meant to be the court of last resort. But in a context like Sudan, where there are no courts of first resort, it's still significant that some kind of justice has been meted out, even if it's two decades too late.
This justice comes at a time when Darfur is again beset by violence due to Sudan's civil war. What are conditions like there today?
A lot of people from Darfur and a lot of these human rights groups and sort of Darfur survivors groups say that what they experienced 20 years ago pales in comparison to what they're experiencing now. Mm. And indeed, the news reports that we're getting from Darfur show that the famine that is spread across the region of Darfur, the militarization during this war that has meant that there are very few safe places for civilians across the Darfur region, as well as, of course, the absolute violence meted out, particularly by the RSF, but the Rapid Support Forces, against different people, you know, women, men, children. The starvation campaigns, particularly in Al-Fashir, the ethnic cleansing campaigns in sort of internally displaced people's camps, especially camps like Zamzam, which was very violently cleared in April. We're seeing the sort of apocalyptic levels of violence playing out in Darfur, as well as a genocide just within the past 2 years against the Masalit community in West Darfur.
Some of the charges against Hoshaib are related to sexual violence. Is sexual violence, rape, also being weaponized in the current conflict?
It absolutely has. Today, Sudan's has the world's largest protection crisis, specifically related to conflict-related sexual violence and violence against women and girls, but we're also seeing sexual violence against men and boys. And in large part, the sexual violence campaign is not and has not been, even 20 years ago, incidental to the violence of this conflict. It is very much part and parcel of how this war is being prosecuted.
And when you say sexual violence is not incidental in this conflict, it is not just militia members or soldiers with free rein to do whatever they want. It is part and parcel of the war plan to damage, stigmatize these communities.
Yes, absolutely. And this goes back many decades. During the first Darfur conflict from 2003 onwards, we heard, for example, from the President Bashir at the time, really disgusting sentiments such as, you know, the women in Darfur should be proud to be raped by men from northern and central Sudan. And that's really a sort of emblematic of the type of thinking that has emanated from Khartoum and is in many ways still being shared by some of these RSF that were part and parcel of that Khartoum regime. And so it is very much intended to humiliate and subjugate, but in many ways, the powers that be, as it were, don't see a problem in it. And I think that has been a major driver of the propensity towards committing sexual violence that we have seen, to how prolific it has been throughout this war.
Khulod Kher is with a think tank called Confluence Advisory. She spoke with us from Nairobi, Kenya. And as she just told us, the conflict in Sudan's Darfur region is far from over. Doctors Without Borders, or MSF, has warned that sexual violence is on the rise. Lucy Achibo is a midwife who's been working with MSF at a hospital in Tawila in North Darfur. She spoke with us today from Chad about what she witnessed in Darfur through her work with women and girls subjected to sexual violence. She began by describing the conditions people face in Tawila, and please be aware she covers some graphic details.
Tawila is overwhelmed with the refugees, the internally displaced persons coming from Zamzam and Al-Fashir. Tawila is overcrowded with all these internally displaced persons. There is a lot of things happening in Tawila. There is no food. There is a lot of malnutrition. There is violence. So the situation is not good.
So people are fleeing from Al-Fashir and Zamzam, but you have been treating people fleeing the violence to the relative safety of Tawila. You've been working with women who've been sexually assaulted and raped by militia members. What kinds of stories have you been hearing from them?
There has been a lot of stories from these women. You know, they when they are moving from Al-Fasha to Tawila, they move in a group. They organize themselves because it is risky to move one or two persons.
They have to cross enemy lines, basically.
Exactly. They have to cross. In the process, every move they take, there is soldiers on the road. And with every soldier they meet, there is torture, there is violence, there is looting, and all sorts of things.
This is RSF soldiers, Rapid Support Forces soldiers?
When I ask this kind of question, they don't differentiate. They say soldiers.
Okay.
So each place they reach, there is a soldier. These people, they do what they want to do. They will stop them. They will select the women and the girls they want, and they take them out in the bush. Or sometimes even they just rape them in front of their relatives, in front of their children, just like that.
Oh, my gosh.
And then sometimes when they take like five girls in the bush, maybe one come back, the rest don't come back. Nobody knows where they go with them. The family don't receive them back.
So you are treating women and girls who've managed to survive and escape this, but many do not end up being reunited with their families.
Exactly. Even if they release all of them, only one person will come to hospital because of fear, because of shame, because of stigma.
How severe are some of the injuries that you are treating because of this rape and sexual assault?
Physical injury or sexually assaulted, I have seen two with the tear, massive tear. Hmm. One is a girl of 8 years, then one was a girl of 15 years. So there was a lot of tears and we have to deal with that situation.
What is the age range of women and girls who you have been treating?
Between 8 years to 45.
So young girls.
Young girls.
So as these groups of civilians are trying to escape Al-Fasher or Zamzam refugee camp and make their way to safety where you were working in Tawila, was there anyone trying to protect them, the Sudanese armed forces or any local security forces?
Nobody. People are just moving, but they are continuously getting assaulted, continuously getting tortured. But there is no one standing in to speak for anybody. There is no protection. There is no protection shelter for anybody.
I hear anger in your voice. Obviously, there's a lot of sadness, too. How are you feeling now that you're a few days out of Darfur? How are you processing all of this?
You know, when I'm speaking about it, I feel a little bit tense. But when I'm not, I sober myself. But it was not a good situation. To speak about it is not something easy. When you have the patient in front of you and someone is telling the sad story in front of you, it's not something easy to cope up with.
Mm-hmm.
The best you can do is not to show to the person, but to try to show that I can support you. After that, you really feel the weight. You feel the weight of the suffering these people are going through.
Doctors Without Borders has warned that there is an increase of sexual violence in Darfur. Is that something that you have seen just in the last several months? Does this seem to be something that is happening more?
This is happening more because in Darfur, between January to August, in Darfur alone, Doctors Without Borders, this is Medicine Sans Frontières, treated over 2,000 sexually assaulted. Then in Tawila, in April and June, Medicine Sans Frontières treated 302. This is only within 2 to 3 months. 302. Then in April up to August, over 600 were treated for sexual violence. Now you see the trend is just increasing.
The 72 hours would be relevant for emergency contraception.
Yes.
So just this week, a former militia leader known as Ali Khosheib, who led militia troops in Darfur in the conflict there over two decades ago, he was convicted for his role in sexual violence and other crimes. Given what you're seeing on the ground right now, does that give you some hope that there might be accountability at some point for those perpetrating the violence happening today? Or does that just feel very far away?
If such has happened, to me, it will give me some hope that maybe it will reduce the violence, maybe. But this violence has already happened. The atrocities they have caused is too much on the civilians. When we look at the trend of the influx from Zamzam and Al-Fasher, so yes, if they convict him, it will be also maybe a lesson. Maybe that will create some fear in people who will still think of causing some havoc on women.
Lucy Achibu is a midwife who spent time working with refugees in Darfur, Sudan. She spoke with us from N'Djamena, the capital of Chad. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. The men's national soccer team in Malaysia is going through a major roster shakeup. Seven players have been suspended after being found ineligible to represent the Southeast Asian country. This is all coming out of an investigation by FIFA, the world soccer body. The World's Bianca Hillier has been following the story, and she joined me to explain. Bianca, what prompted FIFA to scrutinize these players in the first place?
Well, it started with a game back in June when the Malaysian national team played a match against their regional rivals, Vietnam.
Malaysia akan berhadapan dengan seteru mereka, Vietnam.
It went really well for Malaysia. There were seven players new to the team who took the field, and two of them actually scored a goal.
Hantaran ke depan untuk Arif Aiman dengan satu hantaran untuk Hulgado!
So Malaysia ended up winning the match with 4 points, the team's highest score in almost 2 years. And it had also been over a decade since Malaysia had beaten their rivals, Vietnam.
Oh, wow.
So it was overall a big deal and a big upset. And someone got suspicious of the win. They tipped off FIFA the next day saying, you need to investigate what's going on here.
Was this just, you know, somebody on the Vietnam side being a sore loser? Or was there actually anything to be suspicious of?
The Malaysian team had just gotten all these new players just days before that game against Vietnam. FIFA gave the Malaysian Soccer Federation the green light to welcome them to the team. None of them were born in Malaysia themselves. They're from Spain, Argentina, the Netherlands, and Brazil. But the country's soccer federation said each of them has a grandparent who was born in Malaysia. And under FIFA rules, that means they can play for the national team. But the person who sent in this complaint said, you know, I have reason to question their eligibility. So FIFA opened an investigation.
Okay, so they were deemed Malaysian enough to play on this national team because of that grandparent rule.
Yes.
But then that was investigated. What are the results of that investigation?
Yeah, FIFA released the details of their findings in a report this week, and they're accusing the Malaysian Soccer Federation of creating fake birth certificates, doctoring the birth certificates to make it seem like the players were eligible when, according to FIFA, they're not.
So is that Malaysian birth certificates for the grandparents then? Because
yes,
that's what made them eligible?
Yes, that's right. So Malaysian soccer officials had submitted documents saying the grandparents were born in Malaysia. But FIFA found they were actually born in Argentina, Brazil, Spain, and the Netherlands. In a statement, FIFA said that constitutes pure and simple a form of cheating.
Yeah, fake birth certificates, definitely a red flag there. What has the reaction been like in Malaysia?
Well, as far as an official reaction, the Malaysian Soccer Federation says the athletes are legit Malaysian citizens and that any error in this documentation can be chalked up to an administrative mistake, and they plan to file an appeal. It's unclear how long that process would take, and FIFA did not reply to a request for comment. But as far as the fans go, you know, they're not happy. Since these new players joined the team this summer, the Malaysian soccer team has climbed a few spots in the world rankings to their highest ranking in 20 years. So that gave fans hope that maybe there was a bright future ahead for this team. Now they feel hurt and disappointed, and one sports writer called it a national embarrassment, actually. So the country's football federation will need to come back with strong evidence if they want to improve their reputation.
It is pretty common for athletes to switch eligibility and represent not the country where they were born, but maybe where their parents or grandparents were born, right?
It really is pretty common, perhaps especially for players who are born in countries that dominate at a sport, like Argentina or Brazil or Spain for soccer. You know, it's tough to make those national teams.
Sure.
Or the opposite can happen. Countries who historically don't do great on the world stage will go out and actively recruit players who may be eligible through one of these grandparent rules or something like that. They're sometimes called heritage players. But usually, of course, that's all done legally and truthfully.
Right. So what's next for Malaysia's team? How do they move forward?
Well, they move forward with a smaller squad. Those seven players have been suspended for a year. As of now, they can't play for their country or for their clubs. So the Malaysian team has lost most of their starting 11 players, which is bound to make a difference when they take the field just tomorrow in a game against Laos.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of folks will be watching to see how they do on the pitch. The World's Bianca Hillier covers sports for our show and has been filling us in on the eligibility scandal rocking Malaysian soccer. Bianca, thank you so much.
Thanks, Carolyn.
There are certain cultural institutions that hold special status for the people of any given country. The shipping forecast, which turns 100 this year, it's a good example. As the BBC puts it, the daily radio broadcast holds an unrivaled place in the nation's heart. The world's Aaron Schachter explains.
The shipping forecast is, at least from here across the pond in the United States, an acquired taste.
BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency.
But ask any Brit, and she'll tell you that once acquired, it's a hard habit to break.
The general synopsis at 1800. Low, 180 miles west of Shannon, 995. Expected fastnet, 994 by 1800 Friday.
Welsh actress and comedian Ruth Jones discussed this on the BBC Sounds program as part of the network's commemoration of the broadcast's 100th anniversary.
The shipping forecast is so comforting and joyous. And also the words on there were just so strange, weren't they? Like, what's the Dogger?
Dogger Fisherbank.
Yes, exactly. Just and Southfoot Sierra.
Even for a culture that prides itself for being able to carry on with a stiff upper lip, the shipping forecast is valued for being soothing to the soul. Irish poet Seamus Heaney says listening at home, he couldn't wait for the poetry of the forecast.
Green swift upsurges, North Atlantic flux, conjured by that strong gale warning voice, collapse into a sibilant penumbra.
That's from Heaney's poem called, yes, The Shipping Forecast. Okay, so the forecast is comforting and joyous. But what is it? Let's break it down.
Tyne Dogger.
The forecast area comes first. And you should know that the waters surrounding the UK have been broken into 31 patches. The presenter always reads them in the same order, moving clockwise around the British Isles, covering more than a million square miles of sea in total, with names like Dogger, Rockall, and Southwood Sire.
Southwest backing southeast, 3 or 4.
Then comes the weather forecast itself, beginning with wind direction and speed.
Thundery showers. Good, occasionally moderate.
And finally, precipitation and visibility. Thundery showers, in case you missed that, is a very British description of the rain. The shipping forecast actually began as a concept long before radio existed. It was established after a tragic 1859 storm in the Irish Sea. 133 ships went down and more than 800 people drowned. Vice Admiral Robert Fitzroy was head of the newly formed UK Meteorology Office, and he developed the first gale warnings issued on the electronic telegraph. The BBC took over in 1925.
Selsey Bill to Lyme Regis, variable 2 to 4. Fair, good.
These days, there are other ways to get the weather in the UK, obviously. There are special smartphone apps for maritime forecasts, aviation forecasts. You can even get a golf forecast. But it's hard to imagine any of them standing up to the poetry of the original shipping forecast. For the world, I'm Aaron Schachter.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. We'll be right back with more. You're listening to The World.
I'm Tinku Ray, executive editor at The World. The government's decision to eliminate federal funding for public media is a devastating blow to communities nationwide. The World is also affected by this defunding. Since our launch in 1996, The World has been an integral part of the public media system, airing on nearly 370 public radio stations across the US and Canada. taking you to places you may never have heard of and bringing you the stories that connect us on this planet. Without federal support, local stations, especially in rural and underserved areas, face deep cuts or even closure. Vital public service alerts, news, storytelling, and programming like The World will be impacted. The world has weathered many storms, and we remain steadfast in our commitment to being your trusted source for human-centered international news, shared with integrity and care. We believe public media is about truth and access for all. As an independent, non-profit newsroom, we aren't controlled by billionaire owners or corporations. We are sustained by listeners like you. Now, more than ever, we need your help to support our global reporting work and power the future of the world. Please visit theworld.org/give to learn more and to make your donation now. That's theworld.org/give. On behalf of the entire team here at The World, thank you. You make our work possible.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. U.S. envoys Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner are in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt. They're in negotiations aimed at bringing an end to the war in Gaza.
President Trump announced his framework for peace more than a week ago. He's been urging all sides to move quickly. Officials from Hamas and from Israel, Turkey, Qatar, and Egypt are all involved in the talks.
The first steps in the ceasefire process would be Hamas releasing Israeli hostages still held in Gaza. Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners would then be freed from detention in Israel. For many people in Gaza, a breakthrough could not come soon enough.
Mohamed Akhlouk, who works for the Norwegian Refugee Council, is currently in the southern Gaza city of Deir al-Balah. 3 weeks ago, he and his family were at home in Gaza City, determined to remain in their hometown despite the danger. Then they got the news they'd been dreading, another evacuation order from the Israeli military.
Once we received these orders to leave Gaza, I think this is the hardest day of my life.
Akhlouk told me his family had been uprooted six previous times since October 7, 2023, and wanted to stay put.
To be frank with you, we decided as a family this time we will not leave Gaza City because we are suffering a lot in the first and second and third displacement. I become displaced for seven times. So we as family decided to not leave, but the situation, the security situation was more and more unbelievable. The bombardment started to increase, the multi-story buildings destroyed. And the last thing, they targeted two buildings not far away from me, pushed me to conduct a family meeting with my kids, with my wife, to decide what is our plan.
Can you talk about that more? Like, what happened with that announcement? Why did it push you to change your mind, to leave Gaza City?
I have a balcony, the balcony looking to the streets. The displaced people living on the streets, on the tents, the streets is covered by tent. My son, Firas, he's 13 years old. So he counted the tents each day if there is an increase. After this announcement, the number of tents started decreasing, explosions, hearing everywhere. So he came to me and he told me, Daddy, the number of tents decreased today. So I told him, okay.
Your son is out there counting the tents as they come down. Each one that is leaving is a sign that people are fleeing. You were also talking about the bombardments. They got closer and closer. And then it gets so close, that's when you decide it's time to go.
Yes. There is a family received a call from the Israeli to flee. I tried to collect my kids to move. They hit the building directly. All the rebels, all the black smoke come inside my home. They can't breathe. And when we go down, put some wet paper on their mouths.
So you had the tissue over their mouth so they weren't breathing smoke and other particulates.
Yeah, exactly.
So, Mohammed, with all this bombardment happening, what is the moment that you actually decide to leave the house? I mean, that must be really hard to figure out.
the decision, like you take by yourself your soul out of your body. It's not easy at all. And we know this time, if we leave Gaza, we will not back to Gaza again. This is the truth that we have. So I ask my family to decide now, what is our plan? All of them agree to move to the south, to go to the Deir al-Balah, except my wife. She asked me to stay, but we are, as a family, moved together. Not we didn't leave anyone behind. And she is very keen about my daughter. She is in teenagers. To take her to the place we didn't know who is beside us, who is our neighbors. So I respect her decision, but we discuss and we agreed to move together to Deir al-Balah.
What did you and your family decide to take with you this time as you left Gaza City?
It's not easy to secure a truck to take your luggage from north to south. In that day, my kids, Firas, come to me and he asked me, Dad, I think today is calmer than yesterday. Can we postpone to another day? I asked him, why, Firas? He said, I didn't want to move again, and we don't know where we are going to. So we are reaching to collect our luggages. My daughter start to collect her perfumes, some pictures. My son Firas, he bring his mobile. Firas have a PlayStation 4 in our original house. He kept the controller for his PlayStation. The device itself is damaged. So he keep the controller with him anywhere he goes.
That's
because
incredible.
He believe sometime he will purchase a new one.
Mm. So you also went to your father to help him leave his home. What was that like?
You know, this part of my story kill me again and again. Because when I going to my father's home, I find he's arguing with my brother. Because, you know, for the first displacement from Gaza in the beginning of 2023, we didn't take anything with us. We moved by our cars to the south because we believe we will return after 1 week.
Hmm.
This displacement, we know there will be a full destruction of the city. All the people take all their belongings. They take the wooden doors to use for cooking, for heating, for anything. They take everything, the toilet, they take everything they can use or sell with them. Blanket, mattresses, libraries, everything.
And your father was opposed to this because he thought he'd return, right?
My father refused to take anything. Keep the home as it is because we will return back. And I see my brother very nervous. And I trying to relax the situation. Once I started to speak with my father, because he's listening to me a lot, he started crying.
Hmm. It sounds like the optimism of the parent that we will return home versus the cynicism of your brother. Why do you think those two generations disagreed about whether they'd ever return to Gaza City?
I know my father, he believes he will not return. Hmm. But better for him to keep everything like it is. He knows the reality maybe will not be back because the home will be targeted, or because they will not allow us to back, or because there is some looter can take everything. In conclusion, we agreed to not take anything from his home because this is his home, and we all of us, we need to respect his decision. I asked him, okay, my father, let us move. He bring a bag, small bag. Ask him, what you bring with you, Daddy? Where is your clothes? He said, no, I don't want clothes. I can't buy from there. I told him, Daddy, we don't know what's the status of the market there.
Mm.
Bring your clothes. Put your clothes in any bag you have. He said, I don't need anything. Okay, I asked him, where is your medicines? He said, in the bag. When I asked him to check if he collect all the medicines, I didn't find the medicines. I find our pictures, our photos.
Wow.
Not his photos, not his history. He take his photos for his sons, for brothers. This is the only thing he take it with him.
You have said that when the car came to take your father and brother, the driver suggested taking a photo of the house before it disappears.
Yes, he's a very stupid guy.
How did your father react to that, though?
I see his tears. He didn't say anything. Mm. Because, again, and I shout to this guy, please take care of your words in front of this elderly man. Also, to be frank, I take the photo. Because I feel maybe the driver is right. We need to take something to remind us in the future.
I'm speaking with a resident of the Gaza Strip, Mohammed Akluk. He's in Deir al-Balah. He's originally from Gaza City and works with the Norwegian Refugee Council there. So many intense feelings, and it strikes me that it's not just about leaving in the middle of an attack on your city and the risk of getting killed while fleeing. It's about home. I mean, Gaza City is your home. Can you just talk about how important home is when this is what you know?
We are living all our lives in Gaza City. And we didn't travel a lot because there is a lot of restriction of our travels. So we spent our life in this neighborhood with our extended family, with our friends, with our neighbors. We know every market. The market knows us. It's a beautiful city. So we didn't have the chance to choose another place.
So now you and your family are in Deir al-Balah in the south of the Gaza Strip. Deir al-Balah means monastery of the date palm. What is it like there?
People consider it a dangerous area because it's close to the border. But now it's considered a place on the humanitarian zone. The humanitarian mentioned by the Israeli forces. There is a damaged, partially damaged home in Deir al-Balah. There is no water. There is no sewage network. There is no electricity. It's far from the market. A lot of tents we don't know beside us. The most important thing for them before the electricity, the water, it's the privacy. My daughter needs to sleep in her own room.
So how do your kids react when that is not available to them?
They are not happy at all. They are not happy at all. In the same time, they ask me just to be together, to stay together.
Other than that, are they asking for explanations of why all of this is happening? Why the displacement? Why the fighting?
They are aware about everything. My son, Ahmed, 8 years old, he came to me and he said to me, today, the U.S. will come to Sharm el-Sheikh to try to conduct the peace agreement, and we hope the U.S. will make some pressure in both sides. They know what's the trucks entering to Gaza, what's the available for the market for tomorrow. And I am not happy with that because this is not the things that need to be learned. 8 years old. No.
You're worried about them losing their innocence right now.
Exactly. They are now bigger than their ages.
Yeah. Mohammed, you and your family's lives have experienced this violence and upheaval beginning 2 years ago with Israel retaliating for the October 7th attacks. How has the experience changed you?
This experience left deep scars on my heart. I can now be adaptable for anything. I can cope with any bad situation, but my kids, I need the best future for them. If there is a ceasefire announced, I need to take them out of this piece of land.
Outside of the Gaza Strip?
Outside of the Gaza Strip. To think in a health way, we need to think as a human, because we didn't respect the humanity at all. There is no humanitarian principles. This is a big lie. Sorry to say that, but this is what we are saying in our life. We are dead 10 times on a daily basis. From our side, we are dead. So we need to go outside to think as a human, to think how we can improve their future, their education level. And after that, I can decide for myself if I need to stay outside or back to Gaza. But I'm trying to let my kids know about the demonstration across the whole world. So from the European countries, I told my kids, you see what's happening in Europe? Look at Spain, Italy, UK, all this demonstration is for supporting us, maybe more than the Arab country. But for me, I think those 2 years changed my thinking a lot. All the definitions, all the principles, all these trainings about the humanity, how we respect the people. If the world not respect us as a people, they leave us for 2 years under the fire without no one.
Mohammed, how do you think this war is going to end?
For me, to release the hostages, to end the war is the most important thing at the moment, because enough is enough. The people are tired. All the Palestinians now count minute by minute to a peace agreement. We hope to be optimistic in this dark life. Something good will be happens in the future, in the near future.
Mohammed, do you think your father will see his home again in Gaza City?
I hope. Only hope.
We hope so too, Mohammed. Mohammed Akluk, he spoke to us from Deir al-Bala in the Gaza Strip. He works with the Norwegian Refugee Council there. Mohammed Akluk, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And now let's catch you up on some headlines from the world of science.
We'll start with a biggie. It's Nobel Week, and today the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to an international team that figured out a new way to structure molecules. This is for making materials with empty spaces inside, nothing visible to the naked eye. We're talking space at the molecular level. It sounds complicated, but basically the scientific work means we could someday be able to pull water droplets out of the air in the desert, easily separate toxic chemicals from wastewater, and even capture carbon dioxide.
So that is a major headline, but here's some science news you might have missed. A new species of burrowing spider found in the forests of southern Thailand. That discovery was published in the journal Zootaxa. Males of the species are blue-gray and females are orange. The researchers did happen upon one specimen that was blue on one side and orange on the other. It had both male and female characteristics. That's what inspired researchers to name the new species Demarcus Inazuma, after a gender-fluid character named Inazuma from a Japanese comic series.
And finally, in South Africa, human mismanagement of groundwater is causing the coastline not to sink into the ocean, as we're seeing in many global locations, but to rise. That the coast is rising is not new information, but the assumption had been that it was geological forces deep below the Earth's surface that were causing it. A new study suggests otherwise. The current thinking is that the land used to be weighed down by the water that sat on the surface as snow and ice, or just below as groundwater. And now that it's gone, the newly dry land is rebounding.
And those are a few sciencey things you might have missed.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Rebelling against your parents is a rite of passage, starting with putting off homework right up to taking the car without permission. Our next story flips the script a bit. Geraldine Buckley was a teenager in the UK in the 70s when her mother dispatched her on a road trip across Canada. Buckley shared the adventure with GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
I was terrified, absolutely terrified. The kind of feeling that starts deep in the pit of your stomach and goes up until it feels as though a hand is round your neck and you can't get anything out. I was that terrified. Let me explain. It was the late 70s. I was 18, standing by the side of a road in Canada, a long way from home. I was wearing a blue circular uncrushable skirt and holding a sign that said, "The Border." I was about to put my thumb out and hitchhike for the very first time. And that's why I was so terrified. Now, you might be asking, how did I get myself in such a predicament? Well, I blame the whole thing on my mother. You see, my mother had a great love of adventure. But when she was 14 and growing up in Liverpool, the Second World War broke out. And England stayed at war until she was 20. So she said her best adventuring years were swallowed up by bombs and fear and rationing. So she was determined to relive them now vicariously through me. So while other mothers were urging their only daughters to read, to study, to go to college, my mother was saying to me, "For goodness sake, Geraldine, you study far too hard. Put away those books and go out and party." In fact, I'm the only person I know who got a master's degree out of sheer rebellion. So when I was 18, I told her that I was going to go to the Olympic Games in Montreal with my boyfriend. And then we were going to hitchhike from Montreal to New York and fly back to England from there. Well, on that occasion, I wanted my mother to be like other mothers. I wanted her to forbid me to go so I wouldn't have to, and I could tell her she'd ruin my life. But this was my mother, and she said, "Darling, let me help you pack." So that's how I found myself by the side of a road in Canada with my thumb out and my knees shaking. But at least I had my boyfriend standing next to me. He'll keep me safe, I thought. My boyfriend, Ivor, was very respectable. He was 5 years older than me. He traveled extensively, so he explained the rules of the road. "Geraldine," he said, "you always wear good clothes. That way you get a better class of ride. You never get in a vehicle where you're outnumbered. And when you're in that vehicle, you always chat to the driver to build up a rapport. And if you do those things, you're less likely to be murdered." Murdered? I have a vivid imagination. And I could just see my murdered, mutilated body being tossed out of a car on the outskirts of some exotic American city like Akron. I pray, "Lord, please watch over me." And then I wanted to thank every car that whizzed past. But finally, an ancient two-door rusted old Chevy skidded to a halt. Now, I could see through the open passenger window that the driver was alone, which was good. But he had long, unkempt hair, a missing front tooth, and dirt etched in the deep lines of his face. And he said, "I can take you 40 miles. And Ivor said, "Thank you, sir," and got in the back seat with the backpacks and whispered to me, "You get in the front. You're good at talking. Build a rapport." So despite my misgivings, I had to get in. I reached for the seatbelt. It wasn't there. "Oh, it's no use you going for that," said the man. "That dropped off months ago." And he started that car. Well, it looked like a rusted out old jalopy, but he had something powerful under that hood because we went from 0 to 80 in seconds. And the man only had one hand on the wheel because with the other he was chain smoking. And he was lighting the new cigarette with the burning butt of the old one. And he didn't have an ashtray. Well, he didn't actually need an ashtray because right in front of the gear stick, there was a rusted out hole that went down to the road. And that's where he was flicking his ash and the still burning butts of the cigarettes. I was focused on that hole. I was waiting for a spark to hit the engine and the whole car to explode. And I was just thinking, it's all right for my mother, encouraging me to go on this trip, but I bet she's at home now in a nice comfy chair with a cup of tea, which is exactly where I'd like to be. Oh, for a comfy chair and a cup of tea. You see, I never ever thought there'd be so many ways to be killed hitchhiking. And then the man said to me, "I've got a glass eye. Would you like to see it?" And he took out his eye and he put it on my shoulder. I froze. I didn't want that eye going into my lap or down by the floor. I didn't want the man grabbing for it, particularly not as we were going so fast. And then I slowly turned my head And I wasn't quite sure what to say. I mean, really, what is the protocol? When you're eyeball to eyeball with an eyeball. So I turned my head a bit further to see what Ivor's reaction was. His eyes were closed. He was taking a nap. I finally managed, "That's fascinating." And that seemed to placate the man because he didn't say anything else until he dropped us off about 20 minutes later. But I was very relieved that from that moment onwards, he kept both eyes on the road, even though they were 3 feet apart. I was so glad to get out of that car. I watched it disappear until it was just a speck in the distance. But all that time, I felt that eye, now back in the man's head, staring at me through the rear view mirror. But then I remember something my mother had told me while she was helping me pack. She said, "Darling, don't worry, I've prayed. So everywhere on this trip you'll be safe, because the Lord, he'll keep his eye on you." Thank you.
Geraldine Buckley now lives in Maryland. She was featured in GBH's storytelling program, Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the Ford Foundation. By the Henry Luce Foundation. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Jan Elizabeth, Jane Johnson, Kira and Peter McGrath, Leslie Meadowcroft, Maggie Walker, Ravi Mohan, and Rich Gorlick. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.